I'm curious to see. Goda drew out her nightstar, her favorite weapon, with its three hefty spiked globes. She would have to be careful not to lose her footing if she missed her mark. She balanced cautiously, stepping out along the narrow strut and raising her right hand. Fergus pushed himself backwards out of range. You won't get me like that! He squinted down, looking for the next reinforcing bar. Time is on my side, dwarf. Always the most reliable of allies. When Goda came closer still, he jumped off and dropped down, his fingers outstretched to catch the next bar. Even though she only had one weapon with her, Goda decided to contravene the first rule of combat. She hurled the Night's Star at Fergus. The three spiked balls hit his hands and smashed his fingers. Screaming, he plunged, landing on his belly in the very setting the diamond was destined for, a central setting ringed with spikes. No! He shrieked in agony, working the spikes even deeper into his flesh as he struggled. His blood flowed down over the hub and cascaded to the ground. His movements became gradually weaker. Finally, his screams died away. Goda sent a prayer of thanks to Vrakus, climbed carefully down to the central hub where Fergus's body hung. The next problem would be to locate the stone. How do I find it? She called out to Ironheart. Her dwarf mentor was whacking a monster on the paw with his crow's beak and ramming his own sharp helmet into its abdomen, so that black blood streamed down over his head and shoulders.
Slit him open! Top part of his belly! It's only a little while since he swallowed it!
Hopping back to avoid a spear thrust, he sliced the head off his assailant. Goda drew her dagger and forced the body into a sitting position, hauling it off the spikes. The hole in the Magister's chest would not be big enough, so she was just placing the knife tip underneath his ribs when he opened his eyes.
I won't give it up,
he croaked, blood gushing out of his mouth, dripping down his chin.
I shall have my revenge.
He pushed her, and she lost her balance. She fell. Tungdil stormed into the darkness of the chasm, where light was afraid to go. In front of him reared up a being beyond the wit of Teon to create. It would have needed gods such as Gerdlegard had never known. The Cordrian was a vast tower of horror. Its wings were folded close to its huge muscular body, for there was no space in this ravine for the mountainous creature to spread them. Four huge dog-like paws bore its stupendous weight, though the front two limbs seemed more like arms. The rest of its naked body lay in shadow. Its neck was comparatively short, and it had a head like a dragon, but festooned with horns and spikes. Behind the long bony snout glinted four grey eyes. Further back, two blue ones. It was half upright and struggling to place its claws into fissures in the rock to drag itself up. A three-armed beast leaped, shrieking toward Tungdil, long muzzle agape, with a dark red barbed tongue snaking out. The dwarf confronted that tongue quite simply by holding up Bloodthirster, whose wicked cutting edge sliced the flesh, sending the creature whimpering back. Its bleeding tongue segments recoiled into its maw. But Tungdil followed through, cutting the monster in two from top to bottom. Then he turned Bloodthirster on the Cordrian.
Get back in the abyss you crawled out of, he commanded. I don't believe anything is insuperable, whether my opponents look like you or even worse.
The creature's blue eyes focused on him. It dropped down onto its forepaws, but this still meant that its head hovered a good 10 paces above Tungdil. It opened its powerful jaws and roared at the dwarf. Each and every tooth in its head was as big as one Ubariu standing on top of a second. From behind he heard the rattle and clash of weapons and armor, And then Flaga stood at his back with his Ubariu and undergroundlings. With the aid of their armored vehicles, they had managed to defeat the beasts and had stopped up the entrance. The Cordrian was making things easy for them now, because none of the other monsters still in the ravine dared force their way past it.
"Uba, help us now," was Flager's prayer. "How can we deal with this one? I can see the Akruntus might be needed for a monster like this."
Tungdil experienced no fear. With Bloodthirster in his grasp, he was a bundle of confidence, tenacity, and cussedness.
"But if we don't make a start, we'll never know if it can be done without them."
He raced forwards, aiming for the claws, which were now down on the rocky floor.
"While he's stuck in this cleft, we have the advantage. Cut through the tendons, hack at anything you can reach. Sooner or later, we'll have him down."
Flaga watched the dwarf go.
"He's not afraid at all," he murmured admiringly as he lifted his own spear.
Shaft and banner fabric were now drenched in the blood of monsters he had slain.
"Onwards!" he called out,
and cantered off, his breath shallow as he battled with the wound in his side. His warriors followed him and rushed toward the Cordrian with weapons held high, until they heard the infamous roar. But it was not the being in front of them that made the horrendous sound. Flager's steps slackened, and the blood froze in his veins. The ecstasy of battle dispersed and gave way to fear.
"Tungdil! Come back! There are two of them!"
Then the Cordrian opened its great muzzle and swept the warriors with a wave of white fire. With enormous presence of mind, Goda managed to hook her leg over one of the bars. She pulled herself up again, panting hard. She could never have imagined herself capable of these acrobatic tours de force. All that exercise, all those drills, all that training, with heaving and hauling, it was all paying off now. She would never complain again about the harshness of that regime. Ropes with grappling hooks flew past her, fastening themselves to the bars. Some of the monsters were attempting to demolish the artifact, while their comrades, at risk to their own lives, tried to provide cover from attacks by Ironheart and Circa.
"Faster!"
Boindil called up to her. He knew what was making him feel giddy. The woman's dagger had been coated with poison, and it was starting to work. Goda crawled over to Fergus.
"You did not get rid of me."
He drew a rattling breath and drew out his dagger.
"And you have not killed me?"
"I'm going to make up for that." She avoided his lunge, grabbed his useless arm, and removed the knife. It was easy for her now to overcome the fatally wounded Fergus and to ram his own dagger into his body. The man gave one final groan and died. Now she was faced with the part of her task she was not happy about. She fumbled around in the Magister's warm vitals until she found the hard object she was searching for.
"I have it!"
she yelled triumphantly to boost the morale of the defenders below. She cut the diamond out, then gave the corpse a shove so it plummeted to the ground. Goda did not bother to clean the stone, but pressed it, filthy though it was, into the setting, then closed the four fastenings. She stared at the stone.
"Come on now! Do something!"
She rubbed it to make it work. A new roar sounded from the chasm, and a wall of white fire shot out of the cleft, surging across the ground. The burning bodies of Ubariu and undergroundlings were hurled through the air before slamming into the cliff face and extinguishing like sparks. The armored vehicle that was nearest was consumed with fire so that the iron plating peeled off and the wooden frame beneath turned to ash. The Cordrian pushed itself out into the light. With a louder roar than ever, which broke whole boulders off, it forced its way free and was approaching on all fours. It gave another roar of victory as it left the darkness of the abyss. Goda couldn't gauge its size accurately. 20 paces high and 60 paces long? The army ran back from the chasm's edge, overwhelmed by horror. The Cordrian reared up and unfolded its pale wings. The world grew dark, as if a cloud had covered the sun.
"Goda!"
yelled Ironheart, as he felled his last opponent by slamming into its ribcage. Ribs broke, puncturing heart and innards. The three of them, he, Circa, and Rodario, had managed to prevent the destruction of the artifact.
"We're waiting!"
His legs gave way, and he collapsed, sinking down onto the body of his victim. His sight was going, colors swimming together confusedly. Circa stared at the huge pale mass of the Cordrian.
"Tongdil,"
she whispered in horror, grasping the fact that her companion could not have survived. That white fire melted stone and steel.
"He'll be okay," said Ironheart, fighting the effects of the poison and rallying. "The scholar always survives. He is a friend of the gods."
But his face too darkened in concern. A monster like this had never been seen before. It was trampling the Ubariu and undergroundlings, sending out another plume of white fire, killing 500 fighters at one stroke. The last of the armed vehicles was overturned and burnt. Nothing remained but a glowing hulk. The Cordrian was growing stronger with every moment it was able to spend outside its prison gorge. Goda hit out in despair and fury at the stone that was failing them so. She heard a slight click, and it slipped down into place in the setting. A bright silver light shot along the bars of the artifact, slamming into the mighty rings. The symbols started to glow faintly, and then increased in brightness with an opal sheen that made Goda think she was losing her sight. When her vision cleared, she saw a glittering sphere had overlaid the rings of the artifact. A second globe enclosed the opening to the black abyss. She could no longer see the first Cordrian, a severed claw and part of a wing being the only evidence that it had ever emerged from its dungeon. A second version raged wildly behind the delicate but impenetrable barrier. As if possessed, it hurled itself against the thin membrane, to no avail.
"I've done it,"
she whispered, hardly daring to believe it. She gazed at the diamond's matte shimmer. She laughed out loud.
"I've done it!"
"Yes, you have!"
Ironheart returned her joyful words. He tried to stand up, but felt very wobbly.
"Come down carefully so I can hug you."
Rodario placed his hand on Circa's shoulder.
"Tongdil will have made it too," he encouraged.
She let her eyes roam across the sunken battlefield, now filled with the cadavers of beasts and the corpses of her own people. A number of monsters had escaped the axes and swords of their opponents and were fleeing over the edges of the crater to disappear into the distance.
"But the Cordrian has got away," she stammered. "The artifact did not work in time. What now?"
She looked at Rodario.
"There is no hope. The books say, don't give up, let's wait and see. The old books aren't always right, you know."
He leaned on her shoulder for support.
"Come, let's go over to the ravine to find Tongdil."
She gave him a grateful smile. Together with Goda and an unusually pale Ironheart, they made their way over the mountain of bodies. But neither Tongdil nor Flager returned from that battle. Chapter 21. The Outer Lands, east of Letifora, at the Black Abyss. Early autumn, 6241st solar cycle. Circa was standing by the protective globe, with one hand on its shining surface. She could feel a tingling in her fingers from the energy it contained. On the other side, she could see the Cordrian's head. It had slunk back into the ravine to rest and was observing her with its topmost pair of eyes. Its ugly skull lay on its claws. Every so often it selected an Ubaru corpse and swallowed it with obvious enjoyment, before taking up its original position and waiting. Ironheart joined her.
It's waiting for the barrier's strength to let up.
That one and 1,000 others, said Circa sadly. I know we can't open the barrier even for a few minutes to go and look for Tungdil. The Cordrian would be out like a shot. One of them free is bad enough. Ironheart watched her face.
You've been keeping watch for 3 orbits now. You've hardly eaten or drunk anything. Come over to the camp, he begged. The scholar wouldn't want you to starve yourself to death on his account.
He wiped a tear from his eye. She swallowed hard.
I'm coming, she said,
and turned round. The banners of the Ubaru fluttered over the crater. Reinforcements had arrived, and a temporary camp had been set up where their injured could be cared for, and from which any monsters remaining at large could be pursued and hunted down.
They say the Cordrian has taken to the hills, he told her,
to break the silence, and to take her thoughts and his own away from their pain.
Do you think he's dead?
Who do you mean?
Tungdil.
Ironheart took a deep breath, but found breathing ever more difficult. He was relying on his dwarven constitution to help him recover from the poison. It had not killed him outright, so it was not going to do so now.
Common sense would say yes. Only 400 warriors have survived out of 20,000.
He fought down his despair.
But I haven't seen his body with my own eyes, and no one has been able to tell me how he died. So I don't give an orc's fart for common sense. I say he's still alive. He's cutting a path through the ranks of the beasts and is looking for the way out. He will cleanse the ravine of evil, and he won't stop until they're all dead. One fine orbit, there he'll be, all of a sudden. And if it takes 500 cycles...
A new tear trickled down through his beard.
I shan't be able to wait that long, Ironheart, said Circa. Her voice choked with emotion. If he comes back and asks you about me, then...
She wept. Ironheart stood ramrod stiff at first. Then he relented and took her in his arms. Her tears mixed with his own. Undergroundling and dwarf united in grief.
Tell him, she said quietly, that I never chose another after him. Even if this is not the way of my people, I know I can never have another companion like him at my side.
She freed herself from his brotherly embrace and dried her tears on her sleeve.
I shall tell him, he promised gruffly.
In silence, they made their way to the mess tent, where Lot Ionan, Goda, and Radario were waiting, together with the city king's consort. Opposite them sat the Acront, dressed in strange raiment, his head hidden under a light veil. The garment he wore was like the apparel of an Ubario rune master. The monarch's wife looked at Circa and said something to her.
They have been waiting for me, she translated.
The Acront wishes to speak to Goda about the future. Ironheart regarded the mountain of fabric with more than a degree of suspicion.
What is there to discuss?
A rush of heat overwhelmed him. He was perspiring from every pore. His body was sweating out the poison. That had to be good. The Acront raised his voice, and his consort translated the uncanny sounds. In turn, Circa rendered the words into the language spoken in Girdligard. He says the Ubaru have not yet got a new rune master. He says that you, Goda, should remain in Letaphora to guard the artifact until the Ubaru have appointed and trained a rune master from among their ranks. He has noted minute cracks in the sphere containing the Black Abyss, because something has affected the diamond's purity. She waited until the Acront's partner had interpreted some more words. Thus it is essential that someone watches and, if necessary, steps in to strengthen it. It would only be for... Circa did some calculations. 4 cycles. After that she could return to her own country.
And what if she doesn't want to? Ironheart wanted to know.
You can, of course, leave. But consider well. A fracture in the protection would mean disaster for Girdlegard, Circa translated. It would only be for a transitional period. All requests will be met. Goda shall have everything she needs, and she will be rewarded for her services.
Goda sat next to her master, feeling very unsure of herself.
I am not a Maegar, she said.
Yes, you are,
contradicted Lot Ionan, who had his injured arm in a sling.
You have not received the training, but deep inside, you are indeed a Maegar.
You honor me to speak so, venerable sire. But at the moment, I'm not even a Fomula.
Goda was unhappy.
What could I achieve without Lot Ionan's knowledge store?
The Akront spoke once more.
He says you are the only one allowed to touch the diamond and the artifact. You are connected to both, and you are vital. If anything were to happen to the artifact to make the protection sphere collapse, nobody but you would be capable of erecting it again.
Circa lent the Akront her voice.
He asks you to give him 4 cycles.
Goda looked up at Ironheart, but he shook his head so vehemently that his short black braid flipped back and forth.
No, it's absolutely your decision. If you want to stay, I shall not leave your side, he vowed. I shall never leave you alone again. And who knows? Perhaps the scholar will return. Then it's fitting there should be 2 familiar faces to greet him, he grinned.
Then it is agreed, Goda confirmed.
It was obvious that the decision was not an easy one for her.
I shall stay until the Ubariu have a new rune master.
The Akront inclined his head and his eyes glowed purple under the veil. Then he got to his feet and left the tent with his royal consort. He had said all there was to be said. Rodario watched him depart.
So that means that he is not innocent and pure in spirit either, he concluded.
He adjusted the bandage on his leg.
As for me, dear friends, don't be offended, but I'm heading back to Girdlegard in a few orbits' time. Someone's got to report what has been happening here, and that we're safe now. Safe until the next adventure, he added, stroking his beard.
He was looking forward to taking Tassia in his arms again, and to relating his own heroic story.
I tell you, the theatre tents will be overflowing with people wanting to see these events on stage.
Ironheart lifted his eyebrow quizzically.
Tents? Impresario? Since when have you owned more than one?
Not yet, Boendil, my friend, not yet. But it's time I started to expand my little troupe into a theatre empire known throughout the lands.
He nodded to Goda.
I shall come back at intervals to get your news, you'll see.
You'll get lost and end up with the monsters,
the warrior teased, wiping the sweat from his brow.
The hint was enough to unsettle Rodario. I'll have to think of how to get home in one piece. Maybe I should try out that secret path, the invisible mysterious pass that leads to Girdlegard.
He got up.
They'll be striking camp tomorrow to return to Letophora, I understand. And I hope very much that there might be the odd conquest on the way. There are pretty women on the streets.
He raised his hand in farewell and left the mess tent.
I, too, shall be leaving the Outer Lands, said the Magus to the 3 dwarves. I have the feeling that I am needed back home. It is time to find new Fomuli, and to spread the high art of magic in Girdlegard.
When he moved, his back gave him a sharp twinge again. He thought he had spied Nudine's silhouette at the doorway, but the dark shape had disappeared quickly.
It won't be easy to use the magic wellspring at the bottom of the lake, but it will be possible.
Tungdil had some brilliant idea about a metal diving bell.
Goda smiled.
Girdlygard will be glad to have your support. Will you take me on as your Fimula when the 4 cycles have passed?
He stroked her blonde hair.
Who knows what we will have learned in that time, he hinted. Perhaps you will discover a style of magic all your own. I know nothing about Ubaru magic. You will be way ahead of me in that. Even for one such as myself, the ways of magic are unfathomable. It likes to keep something up its sleeve. I can only warn you not to be prodigal with your powers.
He stood up and shook hands with each in turn.
We shall surely meet again. And we shall surely see Tungdil again. I feel it in the depths of my soul, and so my spirits are high.
He turned his bright blue gaze on Circa.
You will live to see him again. Don't despair. Look forward to the dawn when he returns to you from the abyss.
He nodded and left. Circa also bade her friends farewell. Boindil let her depart, even though he still had not told her the punchline. It was not the right time for jokes at the moment. The 2 dwarfs were alone.
Do you know what's bothering me?
Said Ironheart thoughtfully, after the last steps had died away.
Why did the artifact reject Lot Ionan?
Well, if anyone is pure in spirit, then it has to be Lot Ionan, said Goda, springing to the defense of the Magus. And who expects a Magus to sacrifice his life to chastity?
I'm sure he doesn't get up to anything like that now, but I'm sure he remembers what he did when he was younger.
She took his hand.
He is good.
Ironheart was thinking.
Yes, you're right.
He let himself be persuaded. Then his face took on a worried expression.
You know what this means for our iron band?
We shall have to wait another 4 cycles. He sighed.
That will be hard. As hard as any diamond.
Goda laughed. In the meantime, you can train me up to be the very best warrior maiden there's ever been in Girdlygard or the Outer Lands. Your efforts and your noble restraint will receive their reward after 4 cycles. She gave him a long kiss.
And we're not forbidden to kiss.
She smiled. For a second it crossed her mind that they still had to fight the duel she had vowed to her dead grandmother. That could wait. Ironheart touched her cheek, stroking the pale down on her skin.
It will be the best and the worst 4 cycles of my life, he joked. Vrakkus hates me for some reason.
He kissed her and then became earnest.
I pray daily to our creator that he may keep Tungdil safe.
He stood up and went to the doorway, opened it, and looked over toward the black abyss under its shimmering globe.
I wonder where he is, and what he's doing, alone with the misbegotten offspring of strange gods.
Again he wiped the perspiration from his brow. Goda took his hand. She could give him no answer, and she certainly did not share his optimism about Tungdil's fate. She presumed him dead. But she was not going to say so. In silence they both watched the glowing sphere under which lay both hope and horror. You could not have the one without the other. Girdlygard, Parista, Royal Capital of Goregar, Winter 6241st Solar Cycle. Once more, Girdlygard's rulers were meeting to confer. King Bruaron escorted his guests into the first completed chamber of his royal residence. Huge stoves ensured a pleasant temperature despite wintry blizzards without. Bruaron had ordered sumptuous decoration of the hall, commissioning furnishings, frescoes, tapestries and sculptures with taste and care. The impression given was that the rest of the palace was already in place. However, only the outlines of the main structure were visible. The elf Estelin, the monarchs of the human realms, lords of the dwarven kingdoms, and heads of the freeling cities were gathered to hear Rodario's reports from the outer lands. Eloquently, and with compelling and colourful detail, he described recent events at the Black Abyss. And so, with the sacrifice brought by Tungdil Goldhand, the battle ended. We have lost a great hero. He gave his life for Girdlegard. He bowed to his audience. For your sake, and to enable you to sleep soundly in your beds. May this courageous dwarf forever remain in your thoughts, and let us ensure that it is not only the children of the smith who mourn him. With these words, he took his seat to deafening applause, in particular from the dwarfs, on whose faces many a tear glistened. Lot Ionan rose to his feet. Dressed in a light blue robe, he wore white gloves to hide the disfiguring burns he had received from touching the artifact. In his left hand, he held a long, superbly carved walking stick of birchwood.
I see it as our task to utilize this new piece accorded us by the sacrifice of my foster son, Tungdil, and his companions, some of whom remain in the Outer Lands. It is time for reconciliation.
He looked at Estelin.
The elves have been subjected to horrendous treatment meted out in anger. Are you prepared to let bygones be bygones and excuse the deeds targeted at the Aetar?
Estelin looked at Ginsgar calmly.
I insist on an apology for the cruelties received and for the devastation suffered in Alandor. The grand palaces and temples were laid waste, and this was fitting. But it was not right that settlements were torched and destroyed when the inhabitants had nothing to do with the blinkered obsessions of some of my people. Sincere words of atonement and some redress are essential here.
His gaze wandered over to the faces of the assembled dwarves.
With your help, we shall reconstruct our elf realm. When that is done, then there shall be forgiveness for the children of the smith.
Ginsgar opened his mouth to let out a hearty laugh.
Sure thing, Estelin. We can build a few houses for 37 elves, no bother. That forgiveness will be winging its way to us.
If offended by the words and tone, Estelin chose not to show it. He was too sensible to allow himself to respond in kind.
And how about the words of apology from you, Ginsgar Unforce? You led your troops through our groves, plundering and killing.
The laughter ceased abruptly.
And your own apology for the poisoning of the dwarves? That was the Aetar, not the elves.
Estelin looked past Ginsgar and appealed to Xamtiz.
Aetar and elves have nothing in common. Hair splitting, said Ginsgar with contempt. If I don't hear an apology, then you'll have to wait too. In that case, I don't want the dwarves' help in Alandor.
Estelin nodded to the self-appointed High King.
As soon as you are ready to apologize, our two peoples may make a fresh start, but not until then.
The elf leaned back in his seat, making it obvious that he had no more to say. But the door of reconciliation had not been slammed shut. Lot Ionan sent a disapproving look to Ginsgar.
How can you do this, Ginsgar Unforce?
Easily, he replied curtly.
He too had no more to add. The gulf between the two peoples had not grown any narrower. The dead heaped in that gulf prevented any peace.
You will come to your senses, predicted Lot Ionan.
He addressed the whole assembly.
We have heard that the Cordrian has escaped and taken to the hills. It is feared that it will be hiding somewhere between the Fifthling and Fourthling territories to lick its wounds. It is vital that the dwarves patrol not only the passes, but also the remote mountain regions. As soon as the Cordrian is sighted, I must be told.
Didn't Master Rodario say the creature cannot be overpowered?
Issachar asked.
As far as the Upariu and the undergroundlings are concerned, yes.
Lotai Onan indicated his wand.
I am looking into acquiring new Fimuli and Fimulai to train. We shall soon have young people versed in the high art of magic. No one has tried to combat the Cordrian with magic. The rune masters of the Ubariu use their powers differently from my own ways.
He smiled reassuringly.
You see, Queen Issica, I am optimistic.
Queen Wei started to speak.
Then let me add something here, Venerable Magus, to make you more confident still. Even if it has been with great concern that I and my subjects have observed it.
She went to the map of Girdlegard and indicated her own realm.
The water level in the lake is sinking all the time. It's as if someone had pulled the plug out of a bathtub.
Rodario and Lotai Onan exchanged swift glances.
How much has been lost? The actor asked.
He was aware of a possible reason. The force and weight of water gushing in had foiled the Magister's attempt to complete the tunnel. Somewhere in the western part of the Outerlands, a mighty river must be bringing potential devastation.
My citizens who live on solid islands report the level has fallen by as much as 10 paces. Ports and harbours are having to be resited. In some places the lake waters have shrunk so much that people have to walk a whole day to collect fresh water for their homes.
Queen Wei surveyed the assembly solemnly.
The lake is running dry. Soon my subjects will be living not on islands, but on mountain peaks, soaring 1,000 paces up into the sky. It may be good news for you, Lotai Onan, because access to the magic source will be easier, but my people are distraught. You cannot make farmers out of fishermen. I think I can guess what has caused the water to vanish, said the Magus.
He explained his theory. It coincided with Rodario's ideas.
We could deal with the cause if we collapsed the tunnels. I would prefer to undertake a dive to the bottom of the lake for the magic before I see a water-based country turn to desert laid bare. Weyen, without its lakes, is unthinkable. The whole of Girdlegard would suffer. Its lakes give rise to our rivers and streams. The consequences would be dire indeed.
Malin asked to be allowed to speak.
In the name of the human kingdoms, I suggest the dwarves permit our warriors to share guard duties at each of the passes into Girdlegard.
He stood up.
It is only fair that we don't leave the defense of the whole of Girdlegard up to the dwarves. We too want to make our contribution to our safety and security. It will be our gesture of acknowledgement and thanks for them having stood guard loyally these thousands of cycles, losing thousands of their people in the course of that defense.
No,
interrupted Ginsgar.
We'll have no humans in our mountains. We're carrying out our duties properly on our own. Humans would get in the way. They understand neither our way of life nor our way of thinking and fighting. If there were an attack, our soldiers would be hindered by them, not helped.
You have no kingdom under you, Zamtis corrected him. You have appointed yourself High King, that's all.
She inclined her head toward Malin.
As for the firstlings, let me say that humans are welcome to join their efforts to our own. We have suffered too many losses recently and would be grateful for more soldiers to help fill the gaps in our ranks, until our own new recruits are trained up.
Bylanta and Belendalin agreed with her, but Glaimbar and Malbalor refused to cooperate. From the looks exchanged between Ginsgar and Zamtis, it seemed the dwarven folks were headed for a massive clash of wills about who should have overall power. Never had their enmity been displayed so openly. In the past, they had given outsiders the impression of unity, or had formed a common front of silence when disputes occurred. Malin expressed his thanks.
Let us discuss numbers tomorrow.
how many soldiers the firstlings, secondlings, and fourthlings will take. The council now moved to the topic of what line to take with the Ubariu and the mighty empire in the northeast of the outer lands. Against Ginsgar's will, unsurprisingly, it was decided to invite initial contact, if for no other reason than to tackle the Cordrian. The monarchs resolved to leave it in the lap of the gods as to how the relationship developed after that. As it was already late, Bruron closed the meeting. The potentates of Girdlegard were to reconvene in the morning. The kings and queens of the human realms left the hall, and the dwarves remained behind to continue negotiations. Immediately, Xantis slammed her fist down on the table and hissed accusingly at Ginsgar.
"How can you dare to appear here as High King?"
"The matter is settled," he snorted, dismissing her with a smile and gesture.
"You think it is settled. You have a handful of followers, Ginsgar, and they swore loyalty to you when they were high on battle victory. Not more than that."
"Not in my view," Glaimbar spoke. "Ginsgar did what we should have done. Elves or Aetar, what's the difference? When the next Eoil turns up, the 37 pointy ears will go mad and try to found another empire of purity. We're better off without the elves."
He pushed back his chair and knelt before Ginsgar, proffering his weapon. He bowed his head.
"I acknowledge you as my High King, Ginsgar Unforce."
Malbolor also rose and dropped to one knee, repeating the ceremony. Xamtis jumped up.
"So much hot-headed madness from my own realm is unsufferable." She looked at Glaimbar. "I can't think why you are supporting him."
Then she turned her eyes to Malbolor.
"You were afraid of losing authority because you were a thirdling. You think you'll hang on to power and your people will be left in peace if you join the dwarf who calls freelings and thirdlings his enemies."
Her eyes narrowed.
"You are both wrong. You have split the dwarf folks with your decision. I will never accept Ginsgar as High King."
She stood up and knelt before Bylanta, to be joined by Belendalin.
"We swear allegiance to you, High Queen Bylanta Slimfinger of the Clan of the Silverbeards," they chorused.
Then the Freeling City representatives, Bramdel amongst their number, rose and stood at the side of the Fourthling Queen. They swore no oath, but made their commitment plain. Ginsgar jerked to his feet.
"By Vrakus, rebellion!"
he bellowed, reaching for his battle hammer. Malbolor and Glaimbar stood stock still.
"And you?"
he shouted at the Freelings.
"I'll have you back with the dwarves as Vrakus decreed. Your realms outside Girdlegard have seen their last days."
Bramdel gave him a contemptuous look.
"You and your two friends will be responsible for what happens," said Bylanta somberly. "We can prevent the feud," she insisted to Malbolor and Glaimbar, "if you give me your oath of fealty. Avert this rift."
"They have acknowledged me as their ruler," thundered Ginsgar, "and I shall not rest until I am High King of all the dwarven folks. It is your fault! You are the traitors for not supporting my claim."
Bylanta drew back.
"It is better if we leave," she said to the dwarves under her banner. "I pray that Vrakus may instill some sense in you, Ginsgar Unforce."
"That he has done, as my deeds testify,"
he laughed scornfully as they left the hall.
"We shall force them to swear allegiance,"
he told the two kings, laying his hands on their shoulders.
"You will not regret having supported me."
He indicated they should rise.
"I hope you're right."
Glaimbar was on his feet.
"They'll soon understand that what you have done was the only solution for Alendur."
He lowered his voice.
"It's just you stopped too soon, High King."
Ginsgar laughed cruelly and ran his hand over his fire-red beard. "Plenty of time," he hinted with mirth. Let us drink to my confirmation as High King." Malbalor thanked him, but gave his excuses.
"I am too tired, Your Majesty. I should be but poor company, and I am not in the mood to celebrate a victory that is nothing of the kind."
"Make no mistake, Malbalor. It will be a great victory, and we shan't have to wait long." He gave him a friendly tap on the chest. "And then we shall drink together."
"Yes, then we shall."
He responded weakly, taking his cup of water as Glaimbar and Ginsgar led the way. Malbalor was not happy with this stirring of unrest. Xamtes had seen through his motives immediately. As king of the Thirdlings, in joining forces with Ginsgar, he felt he would be gaining security for himself and his folk. He must use the intervening time to prepare for Ginsgar's endeavors. If leaders did not soon become more clear-sighted, the feud about the High King's title would end in internecine strife. It would be the first time dwarves fought each other without the Thirdlings being the cause, as had been the case under Lorimbas. A hazy suspicion rose in his mind.
"Vrakas, give us a reason, or give us Ginsgar's defeat," he murmured,
downing the contents of his cup.
"Save your children."
Girdlegard, Grey Mountains, Realm of the Fifthlings, Winter, 6241st Solar Cycle. Belindis was seated in the throne room, surrounded by the old Fifthling grandeur and the new Fifthling magnificence. She interrupted the talks with the clan elders and opened the letter she had just been handed. It was from Rodario, and contained many pages detailing recent events, and in particular how Tungdil had met his end. Even if no one could say with certainty that he had died, the descriptions of the monsters in the Black Abyss made it impossible that he could have survived.
"Dead," she mouthed.
Tears sprang to her eyes, and the words on the paper became illegible through the mist.
"Queen Belindis," one of the dwarves prompted cautiously. "What has happened? Is King Glaimbar not well?"
"No, no, he is fine."
She forced herself to smile, although her heart was mourning the dwarf she was once linked to with the Iron Band. She had released him from their union, aware that his soul was restless. It had changed nothing in her feelings toward him. She had returned to Glaimbar's side more or less by default. She had not wanted to go back to her firstling clan, and certainly had not wanted to go to the Freelings. Glaimbar's invitation had reached her at a time when few other options were open. He had accepted her back as his spouse without a word about the past, and for this she truly loved him. It was a different love from the one she had for Tungdil, and would always have.
"Would you like to rest?" one of the dwarfs suggested. "Perhaps in your condition."
"Indeed," she said, grateful for the excuse.
She got up to leave. "Forgive me. I should go and lie down. We will meet again shortly before sunset."
The clan leaders bowed, and Belindis walked through the throne room to the door. Her attention was otherwise engaged, but she still noticed she was being stared at. Geroin Leadenring was looking at her with malice. He was the brother of Cindalis Leadenring, the king's second wife. Glaimbar had rejected her in favour of Belindis, and this had aroused much ill feeling. Belindis avoided the gaze and hurried through the corridors, past her own chambers, and directly into the small forge where she was often to be found creating all manner of items in the little leisure time at her disposal. The furnace was always burning, fed from the dragon fire. She cast the pages of the letter one by one onto the glowing coals, observing how they curled in the heat and caught, then turned to ash. The feather-like black flakes flew up the chimney and off, far over the peaks of the Grey Mountains and beyond. Belindis watched them go. She threw a shovelful of coal into the furnace and set the bellows to work. Soon white flames were dancing, sending out tremendous heat. She did not want these lines anywhere near her if they spoke of Tungdil's death. She needed nothing to remind her of him or of his heroic deeds. The finest remembrance he could have left her with, she carried beneath her heart. All the fifthlings presumed the child was Glaimbar's. They should continue to think so. Girdlegard, Queendom of Weyon, near the tunnel. Winter, 6241st solar cycle. It was an early afternoon, but it looked as if night had fallen. A winter storm covered the western part of Weyon, bringing icy rain and the first flakes of snow. Algin saw the foresail belly out dangerously with the storm wind which was chasing the little fishing boat over the crests of the waves. They were travelling so fast that the man was afraid the hull would lift clean out of the water. "Take it down!" he yelled to his friend Rhetar the helmsman, pointing at the threatened wind-filled canvas. "No! If we do that, the lake will get us!" he shouted back against the roar of the storm. "If that sail rips, we're done for!" Algin staggered across the rear deck, and with cold wet fingers tried to undo the knots to drop the topsail. That would be simpler than furling the canvas. "We must head back to harbour!" "One more buoy!" Rhetar called, holding fast to the tiller. "The net at the old sandbank must be full to bursting! This storm will have fair driven the fish in for us." Algin hesitated. Their catch so far had been poor for a whole orbit's fishing. Elria must have guided the shoals out to the very depths of the lake. "All right then," he agreed, taking his hand from the rope. Rhetar grinned and set the course. That was when the fisherman noticed the cavernous hole in the cliff, opening like the circular gullet of a huge worm. It measured a good 10 paces in diameter and was 1/3 underwater. He jabbed Rhetar with his elbow to show him. "Take a look at that," he yelled. "Now I know where the lake water is disappearing out from under our keel. That tunnel must lead straight to the Red Mountains." Rhetar stared at it. "What do the dwarves want with all our water?" He was furious. "I don't get it. Why are they digging?" Both of them saw a monstrous shape fill the entrance. An extended neck with an elongated skull was slowly emerging, and the nostrils flared at the front of the slim muzzle. The creature was testing the air for scents. Its dark green skin was covered in shimmering, damp scales.
"Elria!"
ejaculated Algin.
"What on earth?"
The monster looked their way, drew in a huge breath, and raised its head, its eyes blazing red. Steam shot from its nose. Rhetar swore and swung the helm around. The buoy he'd been so keen to reach was bobbing on the surface by the creature's feet. He abandoned all thoughts of it.
"It's a dragon," stammered Algin. "By Elria, it's exactly like the ones in the stories."
Fascinated, he watched the creature launch itself gracefully into the water. Its broad, shadowy shape was approaching them now, just under the surface, and moving fast, faster than any fish they'd ever seen. The nearer it got, the better able they were to judge its size. From head to tail tip, 50 paces at least, they thought, and 10 wide.
"Hard to port! By all the gods, hard to port!"
he screamed at Rhetar, the fear of death in him.
"Quick! It's Kojaramus!"
The dragon ducked down under their boat and disappeared.
"It's dived! It's spared us!" "Who's going to believe that?" croaked Rhetar. "There's been so much happening in Girdlegard, they'll have to take our word for it."
Algin looked at the gaping hole in the cliff.
We must let Queen Wei know about the tunnel and the dragon right away.
He was not certain whether dwarves or dragons were responsible for digging the tunnel.
To think that one of these creatures had come back after so long. The sagas speak of dragons as being cruel and clever. What does it want here?
Well, I don't care. I'll be offering 10 of my best fish to the goddess for saving me and my boat,
a pale-faced Ritar muttered.
For her protection.
Algin observed the waters beneath their craft filling with light. Their boat was suddenly enveloped in a curtain of blood-red fire. Flames shot around the gunwales 3 paces high. The heat was intolerable. Algin and Ritar screamed in helpless panic. To jump overboard was certain death. All at once, flames burst up through the hull, enrobing mast, sails, and men, and incinerating flesh, skin, and bone. Not a smudge of ash remained. The boat broke apart. The blackened pieces of the wreck tossed on the waves and were driven off by the current. Nothing would be found. No trace of Algin, of Ritar, of their boat, nor of any dragon. This has been a Hachette audio production of The Revenge of the Dwarves, written by Marcus Heitz, translated by Sheila Alabaster, read by Neil Dixon. Produced by Dennis Keogh, recorded by John Kovarik. Sound editing by Vanessa Melendez and Chris Howerton. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Christine M. Farrell. The Revenge of the Dwarves is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, an imprint of Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2005. By Piper Verlag GmbH Munich. English translation copyright 2011 by Sheila Alabaster. Audio production copyright 2018. Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.